today the session is about Marx's activism in the First International, which is a kind of lesser known part about Marx, I suppose. People know him about the theorists of capital, but we'll be talking a bit more about what he thought about socialist organizing in his time. Luca is going to be introducing it. Luca's been a member of Socialist Alternative for some years, involved in the campaign for justice in Palestine. I'll just hand it over to Luca, actually.
Cool. Well, so just to set the scene. So in June of 1871, a journalist for the newspaper The New York World was sent on an investigative assignment that led him to the door of a German-born doctor of philosophy, Karl Marx, in London. His job was to find out more about a kind of shadowy and supposedly secret organisation, the International Working Men's Association. And the International had been propelled to kind of international infamy just a month earlier when the French army had been forced to put down a workers' revolt in Paris, which had lasted 72 days. And rumours all across Europe abounded that the International had organised this conspiracy. So in the minds of the ruling classes of Europe, there was this new existential threat, an all-seeing, monolithic, tightly organised party that could pull the entire European working class behind its banner. The actual reality of the International, what it was and what it stood for, in its time was quite different. For the short 10 years that it was around, it was beset by internal strife and debate, endless financial difficulties. But in that time also, it was an organisation that I think changed the entire character of the labour movement across the world. It was the most powerful means that ever existed in Marx's lifetime for the transmission of the ideas of socialist revolution to the developing workers' movements of the world. It boasted the membership of hundreds of thousands of affiliates all over the world, from Germany to Australia to South Africa. So it wasn't purely just paranoia on the part of ruling classes across Europe and their hangers-on. Some 25 years earlier, Marx had written that there was a spectre that was haunting Europe, and by this point, you could definitely say that that spectre had a program, membership cards, and a headquarters, which was 18 Greek Street in London. So in this talk, I want to talk a bit about how the First International, this important organisation, was built as part of the tradition that we as socialists stand in today, but also the debates between the different currents that made up the International. In particular, I also want to focus on the role that Karl Marx played in the International as a revolutionary activist and fighter. I think this is a history that contradicts the kind of popular notion of Marx as being an armchair-bound philosopher. But if you want that side of his life as well, I can recommend a talk that's happening later today, presented quite thoughtfully in my expectation by Michael Lazarus, who's going to be talking about Marx's life and work, the things that he wrote. But Marx was a revolutionary activist. He's someone who threw himself into the internal life of the party he helped to build and attempted to guide and develop the politics of the organisation. And in that process as well, laid down, I think, some of the fundamental principles of socialist organising that we're still building on today. So hopefully I can get to all of that in the time that I've got. To set the kind of context of the formation of the International Working Men's Association was formed in the context of the emergence of a powerful workers' movement in Europe. In the aftermath of the defeats of the revolutions of 1848, workers' organisation on the entire continent had been pushed backwards. But by the early 1860s, there were signs all across the continent of a kind of tectonic shift. In England, this was most symbolised by the struggle of building workers for the nine-hour day, which launched a long-running struggle but also gave spur to the first kind of new ongoing trade union organisation in the country. In France, the dictatorship of Napoleon III started to ease political restrictions, and ideas of working-class politics and class struggle resurfaced for the first time in a generation. And through this period, there was increasing correspondence and cooperation between workers of different countries. So they would send delegations across borders to meet with striking workers, raise money for strike funds. And the growing spirit of internationalism also led to workers taking up questions well beyond their own borders, questions of politics. So the cause of Italian independence was one that generated broad support in all sections of British society, but particularly the British working class had a sense that they had an interest in fighting for it. There was a deeply rooted sense in the labour movement there that any blow that was struck against the reactionary regimes of Europe would be an advance for democratic rights at home as well. And every successful revolution gave a spur to democratic activity in England. When the American Civil War broke out in the mid-1860s, it split the country sharply along class lines. So the English ruling class were all rallied behind support for the slave-owning South. England's industrialisation, particularly the cotton industry in the north, was built on southern slavery and the plantation system. When Lincoln imposed a blockade on shipping from the south, this decimated the kind of textile industry, leading to mass employment in England. And for this reason, the British elite and the southern slave owners were really counting on the British working class to be a reliable prop in their fight to maintain and reinstitute slavery. But confounding their expectations, the labour movement in England, even in places like Lancaster, where the effect of the cotton blockade created 50% unemployment, rallied behind the cause of the North and abolition. Meetings were held all across the country in favour of abolishing slavery. The most notable one was in March of 1863, where 3,000 workers were packed into St James Hall in London. Marx attended this meeting, which I think was one of the most spectacular and impressive examples of working-class internationalism in British labour history. So it was in this context of working-class ferment and growing internationalism that a meeting was called in St Martin's Hall, another big hall in London, there's quite a few of them, in September of 1864, and more than 2,000 people packed in. This was the fruit of growing discussion and collaboration amongst workers on the continent, and it would be the meeting where the first truly international working class political organisation was founded. Contrary to the myth, which is actually in most history books, that the first international was Marx's kind of brainchild and his creation, Marx only heard about the meeting that was to found the international a few hours before it happened, and he was asked to kind of hastily get his stuff together and help supply a German worker to speak on the podium for the event. So this meeting was the formal constitution of the international. But importantly, the political forces that were assembled at St Martin's Hall that came together that day to form the organisation were far from homogenous in their political outlook and worldview. So under the banner of the international, there were English trade unionists who were hostile to any talk of revolution or radical struggle, Republicans who wanted to paper over kind of class differences in the name of fighting for democracy, and French anarchists who were hostile to any kind of political action whatsoever. What mattered most to Marx, though, was not his agreement or level of agreement with these different political forces, but the extent to which they represented real currents in the workers' movement. So in explaining to his comrades why he'd taken up the invitation, Marx wrote, "I knew that this time the real powers from both London and Paris were present, and so decided to waive my otherwise standing rule to decline any such invitations." This was a crucial opportunity for the Marx Party, as they were known, which meant Marx's small group of collaborators who had held together and developed theory in the really dark years after 1851, to make their ideas felt on a real movement and to shape its development. And at this meeting, an executive committee was nominated and Marx was elected as a representative of the German workers' movement. So Marx played a pivotal role in the early years of the international, shaping the organisation. He proposed that he draft a statement of position to sum up the principles of the new group. This is now known as the inaugural address. And this document, I think, is one that's worth reading because it's a real testament to Marx's political nous in this period. So the address began with a statement that it is a fact that the misery of the working masses has not diminished from 1848 to 1864. Marx documented this with extensive notes that he was preparing for the publication of Capital, which would come out shortly. And while noting the retreat in working class organisations since the defeat of the revolutions in 1848, Marx pointed to two key events: the passing of the limitation of the working day to 10 hours in Britain and the cooperative movement in France. He ended with the achievements of the working class in support for Polish independence and the abolition of slavery, concluding that to conquer political power has therefore become the great duty of the working class. So this address represents, I think, a recognition for Marx that the time had not yet arrived to again speak in what he called the old boldness of language that had characterised documents like the Communist Manifesto that people will be probably a bit familiar with, and that it was necessary to tread carefully to keep political unity between the different forces represented. At the same time, Marx had little interest, I think, in papering over political differences that existed in the international. So the history of the international was a history of political debate and contestation, and it was a contest that Marx sought to win. In his view, the international should be not just a body for passing resolutions, but one that's rooted in the day-to-day reality of working-class struggle. Marx saw the politics, though, of the established forces within the international as the main obstacle to achieving this goal. He was later to put it to one of his friends in a letter: "The history of the international was a continual struggle on the part of the General Council against the sects and amateur experiments which attempted to assert themselves against the genuine movement of the working class." So for Marx, the sect, as he defines it, sees the justification for its existence and its point of honour not in what it has in common with the class movement, but in what particular shibboleth distinguishes it from it. So for Marx, a sect is a group that counterposes its own political proposals and programmes, panaceas, to the reality of working class struggle. And the most prominent sect that exists in this period is the Proudhonists, who are the mostly French followers of Pierre-Joseph Proudhon. Proudhon was, in his time, I'll talk a little bit about his politics, a giant of the workers' movement. He was a veteran of the 1848 revolutions, taking a post in the National Assembly, and in all likelihood, I think he was probably the most known and respected figure in the entire world socialist movement at this point. So even Marx had developed to a certain extent under the tutelage of Proudhon. But he had come in the mid-1840s to see Proudhon's ideas as a barrier to the further development of socialist politics. So Proudhon's followers, in terms of their basic political outlook, they condemned private property as it was currently organised and the state as constraining the development of the individual. So Proudhon rejected the idea that the existing state machine could be used to liberate humanity, to liberate the working class. But he also rejected working class struggle as a means as well, which he saw as unable to lift the general living standards of workers, but also damaging to the cause of agitating for a better society. Instead, his proposal was to argue for the establishment of a people's bank controlled collectively by the working class, which could give low-interest loans to workers to buy their own means of production, and in this way, escape exploitation. So he was for a society that's based on the free and equal exchange of individual producers who own their own machinery, their own plot of land, what be it. And once that would happen, the state, which no longer had any role to play, would just wither away and disappear. Proudhon's ideas, I think it's worth saying, are prototypical to the ideas of the anarchist movement in a couple of key ways, and this will come up a little bit later. Firstly, Proudhon has an individualist standpoint, which rejects all authority. And by authority, he doesn't just mean the authority of the ruling class or the state, but also the authority of collective democratic organisations of the working class, and a rejection of collectivism of any kind, so an anti-communist in that sense. And secondly, an anarchist hostility to politics. So the Proudhonists rejected the idea that the international should take up positions on questions that they saw as outside of the economic sphere, for instance, supporting the struggles of national minorities or legislation to protect workers' rights. And this Proudhonist tradition, even though Proudhon died just after the International was formed, was carried into the organisation in the form of debates at its first Congress in Geneva. This is in 1865. So when debating trade union activity, one of the French delegates reads out a statement condemning strikes. The Proudhonists also argued against the International legislating, campaigning for the legislation of the 8-hour day, because doing so would only reinforce illusions that workers might have in the state. And in response to this, Marx put forward his clearest statement, I think, in his lifetime on the relationship between trade union struggle and the objective, the ultimate objective of abolishing capitalism. So I'm going to quote Marx a couple of times now. Marx says, "If resistance against the encroachments of capital was renounced, workers would be degraded to one level mass of broken wretches past salvation, and certainly disqualify themselves from initiating any larger movements." At the same time, though, he recognised it was important to understand the limitations of what he called guerrilla fights. It was only through political action that workers could cohere themselves as a class and eventually inscribe on their banner the revolutionary watchword, abolition of the wages system. Along the way for Marx, this meant fighting for reforms through the state, like limiting the working day. In enforcing such laws, Marx insisted, the working class does not fortify governmental power, but it transforms that power into an agency for itself. So at this first conference at Geneva, what results is a compromise between Marx and the Proudhonists. All the resolutions that Marx helps to propose on supporting strikes and political action are watered down, and the Proudhonists are still a formidable force. They represent about a third of the delegates at this conference. But just 2 years later, in 1868 at the Brussels Congress, they were decisively defeated. Marx's supporters managed to sideline the French's kind of utopian schemes about mutual credit societies, people's banks, and win resolutions that support strikes and the nationalisation of major industries and resources, like the railways, the land, the water and the forests. So this was a decisive turning point in the history of the International, because it meant that for the first time, it was an organisation that was explicitly stamped with socialist politics. And in these debates, Marx could rely most of the time on the support of the leading British trade unionists who made up a section of the International. They acted as a real backbone and generally supported his position. One example, when the French delegates at the first conference tried to pass a resolution urging the banning of all non-manual workers from the conference, all intellectuals, the trade unionists leapt to Marx's defence, holding him up as an eminent example of the kind of service that intellectuals could render to the workers' movement. And one stated, "Among those members, I will mention one only, Citizen Marx, who has devoted all his life to the triumph of the working classes." However, while Marx saw the methods of political struggle and trade union organisation as a means to a greater end, the trade union leaders who sat on the General Council, they saw this as an end in itself, and I think that's important to say. And they were increasingly accommodating themselves to the existing political setup and existing order, particularly the Liberal Party, which was in power at the time, which represented the progressive wing of British capital. Marx was dismayed numerous times at their kind of tendency to look for compromise with the system and the state, particularly when the General Council was pushed towards supporting the Reform Bill of 1866, which was a suffrage reform bill, but which would only grant the vote to a small fraction of the working class, far short of what the International had previously demanded. So long as the International, though, was building on its ability to win reforms in the here and now, this kind of uneasy alliance between Marx and his followers as revolutionaries and the trade union leaders could hold together. But Marx wanted to win the International to the position of functioning as a revolutionary organisation, so that alliance couldn't hold for very long. Marx learned an important lesson from some of these debates, I think, against both the trade union leaders who were willing to be brought under the umbrella of liberal politics and the anarchists who denied the necessity of political action at all. And for Marx, he emphasised the central argument, the primacy of independent working-class political action. And this was to be increasingly emphasised through the years of the International. So Marx said in 1871, and got this passed as an official statement, "The working class cannot act as a class except by constituting itself into a political party separate and distinct from and opposed to all old parties formed by property classes." So given Marx's like relative isolation from public life in the years leading up to the formation of the International, he was able to carry off a pretty remarkable, I think, series of victories in the early years of the organisation and indelibly kind of imprint his mark on it. Marx personally drafted basically every formal statement of position that the International put out on every question from education and religion to trade union struggle and really shaped the politics of the organisation. I think there are a few reasons why he and his followers could make such an impact on the organisation. Firstly, just developments in society and in capitalism through this period, the growth of the working class and industry were undercutting the viability of arguments like the ones that the Proudhonists put forward. So Proudhon's glorification of the individual producer kind of controlling their own patch of land or property reflected a world that Proudhon grew up in, dominated by peasants and small workshops, one that was rapidly disappearing. So the growth of collective industry with workers being concentrated in larger and larger numbers actually forced by necessity some of even the most loyal Proudhonists to acknowledge the necessity of trade union organisation and collective action. This expressed itself in the French section of the International in a split. By 1870, the leadership of the French section was won by a man named Eugene Violon, who was to be a future leader of the Paris Commune. His own ideas were closer to a kind of syndicalism, which accepted the necessity of mass trade union struggle and collective ownership of the means of production. Secondly, Marx had credibility in the International because he didn't just limit his arguments to theoretical work, but he was an activist who got down to the nitty-gritty of politics, and he argued every theoretician should do the same. And thirdly, I think really importantly, in looking for ammunition against his opponents in the International and seeking to win debates, Marx had a pretty good supply of ammunition to draw on, which was the theoretical work that he'd done in the 10 years of isolation after the defeat of the last wave of revolutions. The stuff that some people can see as a retreat from politics, you know, going back to the library, trying to analyse the system of capitalism, how it works, how our own agency can work. That meant that Marx and Engels in these debates weren't just reaching in the dark for solutions to the questions that came up. So Marx's argument that the International should strive to be a body based on working-class struggle was, I think, vindicated in the extraordinary growth that the organisation achieved in its early years. And its prestige, I think, undoubtedly grew not as an organisation that could pass kind of, highfalutin resolutions, but as a party of struggle. For many workers, the key point of attraction for the International was its ability to foster practical solidarity between workers in different countries. So the 1866 Taylor strike in London and Edinburgh, the 1867 Paris bronze workers strike, the 1868 Geneva building workers strike, and the very bloody Belgian miners' revolt of 1868. The International intervened into all of these to stop the importation of scab labour, to break picket lines, and to raise strike funds and kind of publish political propaganda. Every single one of these strikes, both successful and unsuccessful, raised the prestige of the International in the eyes of workers all across the continent and led to workers all over the place affiliating, from the most far-flung regions of the world. And at every step of the way in this process as well, I think it's important to say that Marx was practically involved at the kind of most grassroots level. So everything from coordinating strike support, writing up pamphlets to explain the position of striking workers, and signing individual membership cards, trying to get people to join the International. The success of these early years led Marx to write pretty glowingly to his closest comrade, "When the next revolution comes, and that will perhaps be sooner than might appear, we will have this mighty engine at our disposal, and with no money to boot, we can be well satisfied." So the kind of continual theme in Marx's life of being cash-strapped, that extends to the International as an organisation as well, through this whole period. But new developments in the class struggle would provide not just new opportunities for growth, but new challenges as well, and I think some of the biggest tests for the International were the political questions that it had to confront as an organisation. One of them that I want to talk about was the question of Ireland. So the question of independence for Ireland came to a head again in Britain in 1867 when a group of Irish nationalists belonging to a secret Fenian society were arrested carrying out an armed attack in London to free their imprisoned comrades who had been locked up there. A broad movement emerged in England, campaigning against the scheduled execution of these independence fighters. For Marx, unequivocal support for the Irish struggle was important, and he did unequivocally support it, but it wasn't enough. As was the case many times in Marx's life, new political developments forced him to clarify his own ideas and make political advances. He had to have something to offer these movements in terms of strategy and concrete arguments. So Marx's basic position up until this point had been on the question of national liberation struggles, that on the whole, they represented a progressive force because they represented challenges to feudal and absolutist regimes, and building new national states was a precondition for the development of capitalism. As a general assessment of the dynamics of these struggles, I think this is undoubtedly correct. But obviously the problem was that the Irish struggle was not one directed at an absolutist feudal regime or a prop of the old order, but the most thoroughly modern capitalist state that existed in the world at that time. So Marx had to reframe the question, changing his focus from the relationship between feudal and capitalist states to the relationship between imperialist and colonised countries. The most immediate question on Marx's mind was exactly what kind of strategic arguments he could offer up for the movement and the international could play a role in pursuing. And again on this question, Marx was forced to revise his previous understanding of the question. When first confronted with the issue of Irish independence in the 1840s, Marx and Engels believed that Ireland would be liberated not by the Irish national movement, but by the English working class movement. So the victory of the working class and the abolition of capitalism in the entire United Kingdom would be the precondition for the victory of Ireland. But in the prevailing 2 decades since then, I think that analysis had been superseded, and this was something that Marx came to terms with. For a couple of reasons. Well, mainly that in the 1840s, when they'd first formulated their position, the English working class was the most conscious and politically advanced and organised working class in the entire world. Chartism, which was the first mass working class movement, which gripped the English working class in the late 1830s, early 1840s, had explicitly taken up the demand for Irish independence as part of its broader revolutionary programme. But in the prevailing 20 years, and a whole kind of series of defeats, a kind of conservatism had gripped the English working class. This was a reality that Marx and Engels were forced to grapple with. England was a key site of their intervention. It's where they were located through this entire period. And they had to answer the question of how this kind of conservatism had set over the class. One of the key kind of insights that they had about this question related to the role of Britain as a major imperialist power on the world stage, and the role that that played in binding English workers to their rulers and diluting a kind of class sentiment and sense of class consciousness. So Marx wrote, "The ordinary English worker hates the Irish worker as a competitor who forces down the standard of life. In relation to the Irish worker, he feels himself to be a member of the dominant nation and therefore makes himself a tool of his aristocrats and capitalists against Ireland." So now Marx saw that the lever of struggle had to be applied in Ireland, not in England, and that the success of the national liberation struggle there would be a precondition for the victory of English workers. He wrote, "The English working class will never be able to do anything decisive here in England before they separate their attitudes towards Ireland definitively from that of the ruling classes." And in this kind of struggle, Marx saw the international as playing a crucial role. He said, to hasten the social revolution in England is the most important object of the international. The sole means of doing so is to make Ireland independent. The special task of the General Council is to awaken the consciousness of the working class to the notion that for them, the national emancipation of Ireland is not a question of abstract justice or humanitarian sentiment, but the first condition of their own social emancipation. And the actual activity of the international was able to make some pretty impressive inroads into the English working class on this question. Towards the end of 1869, they were able to organise a demonstration of 100,000 people in London calling for the amnesty of all Irish political prisoners. The whole Marx family were in attendance at this demonstration, and Marx afterwards commented that the main feature of it was that at least a section of the English working class had started to shed its prejudice towards the Irish. So that was not a bad result at all, in my opinion. This campaign, though, for Irish independence, with all its anti-state implications, proved to be a bit too much for some of the leading trade unionists on the General Council. So George Odgar, the figure I want to talk about particularly the most, in the heat of the kind of hysterical press campaign, you can imagine, was kind of rained down on the international for supporting a group of people who wanted to overthrow the British state. He distanced himself very quickly from the statements that the General Council made, motivated by his own parliamentary career and his personal support for the Liberal Prime Minister Gladstone. And in this kind of instance, Marx recognised the danger of this kind of tendency, which was only newly expressing itself, for the Labour movement to become politically subordinated to a wing of the ruling class. Marx consciously tried to use the issue of Ireland as a wedge between George Odger and the other trade unionists and the Liberal Party, and to preserve working class political independence. But those divisions, which were only kind of creaking up at that point, were going to be blown very wide apart just a couple of years later with the dramatic re-entry of working class revolution onto the political stage. And that's, of course, the Paris Commune, which is the next thing I wanted to talk about. So the Paris Commune in 1871 was, I think, the greatest urban insurrection that happened in the 19th century. It was born, like so many working class revolutions that we've seen since, out of the crisis of war. So a conflict between the dictatorships of Bismarck in Prussia and Louis Napoleon in France led first to the fall of Napoleon's regime and then the formation of a new French Republic. So Adolphe Thiers, the head of the national government that emerged, was emblematic, I think, of everything that workers hated and distrusted about the new government. He had been responsible already for drowning workers' revolts in Lyon and Paris in blood, and after 4 months of siege, Paris was surrounded by the Prussian army, had refused to do anything to alleviate the acute social crisis that existed there. And food riots kind of broke out through the start of 1871. But most importantly, for all the Parisian workers that were trapped in this siege, their main criticism of the government and the main expectation they placed on it was that it would defend them to the fullest against Prussia and defend the new republic that had been built. But this was not the priority of the Thiers government. One of the generals of his government said afterwards that the diplomacy of the government and almost all of the defence revolved around one thing, the fear of revolt. So the national government wanted to protect the class interests that it represented by signing an armistice. And most importantly, disarming the 300,000 strong militia that still existed in France under arms, made up mostly of workers who were itching to take power into their own hands. So the government fell hard on the side of disarming the last kind of armed group in Paris, and their attempt to disarm the working class of Paris sparked off the revolution. The Paris National Guard and all the revolutionary organisations there that had for months been waiting for the right moment to strike, they seized the opportunity, and the Parisian working class in March of 1871 rose up under arms and seized control of the capital and initiated the Paris Commune. So Marx was later to say that time was not allowed to the Commune. Faced by acute social crisis, the problem of war, and their isolation in a primarily kind of rural country full of peasants who were mostly hostile to the aims of the revolution, the Commune only lasted 72 days. In this time, though, the first working class government in history, the first government controlled by the working class, made the first tentative steps towards their own emancipation. So a few examples of what they achieved. All rents that were owing to landlords for the period of the siege were cancelled. The long-standing demand of bakers for their night work to be abolished was granted, and factories and workshops that were abandoned by their bosses, you know, out of fear during the revolution, were seized by the trade unions and cooperatives and run by workers themselves so that production could be restarted. And despite the severity of the situation, and, you know, you have to know that most of these workers participating in the revolt were fairly certain that they were going to die, there was a festive atmosphere in Paris through all of March and April as they held power, leading one English observer to write that people moved about the city as if in a dream. Only 5 days after that comment was made, though, government forces from Versailles broke into Paris to begin the crushing of the revolution. Found one letter from a Parisian worker who was writing back to his family in the provinces. He'd only kind of newly moved into the cities a few months before the revolution. And he wrote to his family, "Tell the people that we do not want civil war, but if those bandits remove us from the capital, we will burn Paris down rather than let them defeat us." So the Communards made good on this promise in the last days of fighting. Many of the fires that they lit as the forces emerged to surround them were lit as acts of self-defence, but by the end, many of the kind of acts, like the burning down of the prefecture of police building in the centre of Paris, were just pure, I think, acts of class revenge. So the Commune came to a very bloody end 72 days after it had begun. The heroes, between 6 or 20,000 of them, were lined up and shot. And 5 days after the barricades had come down and order was restored in Paris, Marx had produced a new work titled The Civil War in France on behalf of the International. And this pamphlet, if people haven't read it, I think is one of the most significant documents that Marx wrote in his lifetime, not just for its defence of the Paris Commune and condemnation of the national government, which is scathing in terms of its moral outrage, but because it represented the most serious attempt, I think, on behalf of anyone in the socialist movement, to come to terms with the significance of this working class revolution for revolutionary theory and action. So for Marx, the most important thing about the Commune was not the kind of concrete reforms or things I mentioned before that it was able to accomplish. The most important thing was, as Marx put it, its true secret was this. It was essentially a working class government, the produce of the struggle between the producing against the appropriating class, the political form at last discovered under which to work out the economical emancipation of labour. It was through the process of a real workers' revolution in Marx's lifetime that he was finally able to clarify the question of what form working class power would take. His central lesson was that the working class couldn't just seize the pre-existing state machinery and wield it for its own purposes. Workers had to smash the old state and generate new forms of political organising, which both suited better their task of emancipation but also prefigured a radically democratic society, self-governed and self-administered. So for more than 7 years within the International, Marx had restrained himself and spoken publicly in words of careful, studied moderation. But now, with a new kind of period of working class revolution emerging, he finally kind of ran the red flag high and returned to that old boldness of language that had characterised his earlier political organising. But the Civil War in France, his pamphlet, I think was not just important from the standpoint of Marx's own political development. The pamphlet solidified the legend of the Paris Commune in the minds of the most kind of political and conscious workers all across Europe and provided an incredibly important series of lessons that would shape the workers' movement in the decades to come. There's not a single work written by Marx in his lifetime that was so widely read so quickly. It was translated into most European languages and went through 3 editions in the first 2 months. And on the top of the handbill for the second English edition was written with a great sense of urgency in all caps, "This ought to be read by every English workman." So it was the Commune and Marx's defence of it that propelled the International into legendary status, as an icon and a hope for the workers' movement all across Europe. But it would also open up the last phase of the International before it all came crashing down. Within 3 short years, the International would be effectively defunct and would pass away relatively unnoticed. So what happened to this, you know, big, mighty and important political organisation? I think essentially the unity of the different political forces that were represented in the International that it initially gave it its kind of vitality, its broadness and its strength couldn't hold forever. So those tensions really came to a halt with the Commune. On the one hand, the reformist trade union leaders who had always been hesitant and sceptical of the more kind of radical tendencies within the International abandoned it very quickly after the Paris Commune and the International's defence of what workers had done there. You can imagine, for these reformist trade union leaders, their aspirations for seats in Parliament and to dine in the halls of power didn't sit very comfortably alongside being a member of a leadership body which called for working class insurrection. On the other side, the anarchists, defeated in the form of Proudhon and his followers, but now re-emerged in the form of the Russian anarchist Mikhail Bakunin and his supporters, basically attempted to take over the International and eventually split it and led to collapse. So Bakunin set up a secret society within the International. I'm only going to say a few words about this because it's an entire talk, I think, on its own, and people can raise in the discussion if they have comments or questions. But Bakunin set up a secret society within the International which tried to take over the General Council. When that seemed doomed to failure, he determined to destroy the organisation. And for Marx and Engels at this point, the most important thing, I think, was to protect the legacy of the International. Engels put it nicely, I think, when he said, "If we had come out in a conciliatory way, if we had hushed up the breaking out of the split, what would have been the result? The Bakuninists would have got another year to perpetuate stupidities and infamies, because principles would already have been sacrificed. The International would indeed have gone to pieces through unity." The organisation had become a beacon and a legend for workers all across Europe, so rather than have it taken over by people that would perpetuate those kinds of stupidities, Marx and Engels resolved to move the headquarters to New York and let it die a peaceful death there. So, just to say a few words in conclusion, obviously the International, as an organisation, it never existed long enough to lead a working class revolution to victory itself. So why talk about it today? Firstly, I think because the International is this really essential part of our socialist tradition. Through it, Marx laid down a foundation of theory and practice for socialists to follow in generations to come. So in his kind of statements and positions on the relationship between immediate working class struggles and the aim of revolution, his approach to the national question, these kind of were the building blocks of socialist strategy that people like Lenin and Trotsky would develop in their time. But it also is important, I think, not just for the lessons we can draw, but because the International had a lasting impact on the world workers' movement. Obviously, its collapse was a serious blow to Marx and Engels, who dedicated a pretty serious portion of their lives to it at a time when they were really at the height of their powers. But they recognised that it was only one phase in a broader historical movement towards organising around working class self-emancipation. And Engels, who I haven't mentioned very much in this talk, but was behind Marx as a collaborator, as an activist, and as a strategist every step of the way, I'm going to let him have the last kind of word on the historical role of the International, because I think he, in this quote, displays a pretty keen awareness of the historic process and how we understand it. So he wrote in a letter in 1874 that the International belonged to the period of the Second Empire in France, when the oppression throughout Europe prescribed unity and abstention from all internal controversy for the labour movement, then just reawakening. It was the moment when the common cosmopolitan interests of the proletariat could come to the fore. The International dominated 10 years of one side of European history, the side on which the future lies. But in its old form, it has outlived itself. I think the next International, he concluded, will be directly communist in character and openly proclaim our principles. And I'll leave it there.